Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're looking at something, well, quite special. A single, incredibly detailed document. It's a study focused entirely on the Jabal al-Akrad region, which you might also know by its historical name, Afrin.
It really is detailed. This isn't just, a history summary or a quick geographical overview. This one document takes you through millions of years of geology, millennia of human settlement, ancient empires.
Yeah.
Right down to the modern landscape, the culture, the resources, even snippets of daily life. It's quite something.
Right. So our task today is to unpack this source. We want to dig into it and pull out the most compelling facts, maybe some unexpected links, the really vital insights it offers. What can this study tell us about this remarkable piece of land and the people who've lived there for, well, generations upon generations?
Okay, let's start with the land itself, the geography. The study places Jabal al-Akrad very precisely. It's in the far northwest of Syria. We're talking coordinates like 36 degrees, 33 minutes to 37 degrees and 3 minutes east,
yeah,
and 36 degrees, 21 minute to 36 degrees, 50 minutes north. And size-wise, it's roughly 60 kilometers long, about 30 kilometers wide.
Okay, so a defined area. But it sounds like it's packed with geographical features.
Definitely. The study describes slopes, steeper to the west, gentler to the east. There's a depression to the west, too. And it mentions specific valleys, like Wadi al-Nishab, that's Jilieh Tiran, locally, and Wadi Maidan, or Jilieh Maidanin. There's even a highest point noted, Posi Zoyeh on Jabal Belbil.
And all this sits on top of, well, incredibly ancient geology.
Exactly. Millions of years of Earth's history shaped this place. The study mentions elements from the huge Arabic tectonic plate and something called the ophiolite complex being involved.
Ophiolite complex. What's that exactly, according to the study?
It describes it as basically containing very old, deep earth rock, sometimes called green rocks, pushed closer to the surface over time. And these ancient layers tell a story. You find older rocks, Cretaceous and Jurassic, more in the north, while younger ones, Paleogene and Neogene, are more common down south.
Different ages of rock in different areas. Does it get specific about the types?
Oh, yes. It lists things like Cretaceous limestone, dolomites, marls, clays, the whole geological picture. And it's how these layers were folded and pushed up over time that created the main features, like the Jabal al-Akrad mountain range itself and the lower areas like the Afrin Depression.
And presumably resources are hidden within these layers. Does the study look into that?
It does. It mentions exploration for oil, gas, asphalt, even brown coal.
Mm.
But it notes that despite a lot of geophysical work, these studies haven't confirmed any commercially viable reserves of those particular things.
Okay, so maybe not a major fossil fuel source based on this document. Any other materials?
Well, there's oil shale mentioned near Kokan Ejere. But again, the study says it's not really commercially viable compared to other Syrian deposits. Where it gets more interesting is with iron ore.
Iron ore. Okay, that feels more tangible, connecting the land to human history and technology.
Absolutely. The study points to deposits in specific places like Shadianli, north of Raho, and Maidanlia. It even gives estimates for the reserves and talks about the types of minerals, hematite, hydrogoethite, and the iron content. It says it can range from about 20% up to 50%. That's definitely a resource.
And the most crucial resource of all, water. How does the geology play into that?
This is where those ancient rocks become really important for life today. The study stresses that the Cretaceous and Jurassic rocks, especially layers called Cenomanian and Turonian, which are widespread, are excellent water reservoirs.
So the actual rock structure holds the water.
Exactly. And it explains how things like karst topography, you know, where water has dissolved limestone over ages, creating underground channels and caves and faults, cracks in the rock, really boost water storage and flow. The study even links specific water sources in the region used for drinking and irrigation directly to these geological layers. It mentions, for instance, that water sources around northern Aleppo and Afrin are tied to a layer called the Helvetian. It's a type of organic limestone with lots of natural cracks and karst features, perfect for groundwater.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how geology from millions of years ago dictates where people get water today, and that link between land and people goes back an incredibly long way here.
An unbelievably long way. The study moves from geology right into the earliest human traces. It highlights the discovery of Neanderthal remains in Duderia Cave. We're talking 100,000 years ago.
100,000 years, it's hard to even process that. And wasn't there a particularly famous find there?
Yes. The study really focuses on the 1978 discovery. It was the fossilized remains of a Neanderthal baby. And this was huge globally because, at the time, it was thought to be the first complete skeleton found still in its original burial site. It drew researchers from everywhere.
Wow. a discovery of that scale right in this region. What else did the study say about Dudairia Cave?
Well, the name itself is interesting. Dudairia means two gates in Kurdish, according to the source. Inside, they found ash, suggesting fire was used maybe for cooking or warmth, and animal bones, too, mostly wild sheep and goat. So you get a little glimpse into their survival strategies way back then.
Amazing. Not just bones, but clues about life. Okay, jumping forward significantly in time, the study connects the region to major ancient empires and some really surprising linguistic links.
Yes, this part is fascinating. It talks about the Hittites, a major power back then, and it points out that the word Takht shows up in a treaty between a Hittite king and the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses.
Yeah.
The incredible thing is Takht is still used in Kurdish today. Same basic meaning, throne, seat of power, especially regarding inheritance. And there's a related Kurdish word, paytext, which means capital city.
That's remarkable. A single word echoing down from an ancient Hittite-Egyptian treaty to modern Kurdish.
It really is. The study also mentions other Hittite aspects noted in the document, like their writing systems, hieroglyphic, and cuneiform, and how Hittite was apparently an international language for diplomacy and science back then. It also highlights their skills, livestock, farming the sort of lands, building fortifications, temples like the one in Aindara, and metalworking, specifically turning iron ore, like the deposits found in the region, into steel, and making seals, too.
So those local iron deposits potentially fueled their technological edge in steel. Then the study moves on to another major group.
Yes, the Hurrians and the Mitanni Kingdom, which was ruled by Hurrians. The study describes how the Hurrian state formed after the Akkadian Empire fell. Their capital, Urkish, was in the Khabur Triangle, and their kingdom stretched quite far, even to the Diyala River in Iraqi Kurdistan.
And their influence pops up in texts from other ancient cities.
That's right. The study mentions Hurrian names appearing in texts from Mari, Tel al-Rima, Shagar Bazar. It lists some of the Mitanni kings, too, like Partitarna, Shutarna, Shashtatar.
And the Mitanni are known for links with Egypt, aren't they? That seems like a big historical connection.
A huge one. The study goes into detail about their relationship, citing friendly diplomatic language in letters found at Tel al-Amarna in Egypt. There's this one amazing story it mentions. King Shutarna sent a statue of their goddess Ishtar, they called her Shoshka, all the way from Nineveh down to Egypt. Apparently, it was believed the statue had healing powers for the pharaoh.
A healing statue making that journey. And wasn't there an even closer tie, like a marriage?
Yes, a major one. The study explains the Mitanni king sent his daughter, Tadukepa, to marry the Egyptian pharaoh. And this princess, Tadukepa, history knows her better by another name, Nefertiti.
Wait. The Nefertiti, the famous Egyptian queen. She was originally a Mitanni princess from this broader cultural sphere. That's a massive connection the study highlights.
It really is quite something. The study also touches briefly on the Mitanni-Hurrian language, some of their gods, and notes a linguistic link suggesting early contact between Hittites and Hurrians through a moon god's name. And another little linguistic nugget it mentions, the Kurdish name Kabat is still used today.
Wow, from ancient treaty words to names still in use, these connections are powerful. Okay, finally in this ancient section, the maids.
Yes, the study presents the viewpoint, which it says is supported by most researchers and archaeologists it cites, that the language of the Median Empire was Kurdish, and that Kurds are descendants of the maids. It even includes a quote from the historian Minorsky backing this view.
That's a significant statement about Kurdish origins, presented as the consensus view within this particular source material. This document is just packed with history.
It really covers a lot of ground.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Roj Bosh Hannah. Ah, perfect timing.
Let's see. This is good chai today. Really good. Nice and warm. Perfectly balanced. Not bitter at all.
Excellent. Just what we needed. A moment to let all that ancient history sink in Nefertiti Neanderthals.
Okay, feeling refreshed. Let's pick up the historical thread again. After those ancient empires, where does the study take us next?
It moves into the Hellenistic period with the Seleucids. It mentions how the founder, Seleucus Nicator, made his mark by renaming cities. Like Aleppo became Beroa and Nebuchadnezzar became Cyrus, reflecting that Greek influence after he rebuilt them.
Right, changing the map to reflect the new power.
Then comes the Roman and Byzantine eras. The study talks about Christianity spreading, but also periods of Roman persecution. It mentions the region, called the province of Corcia then, gaining a sort of semi-independent status, linked to the major city of Antioch. It also covers the back and forth with Sasanian invasions from Persia and then Byzantine reconquest. And it connects this era to figures like Maron, described as an early Christian preacher who supposedly tore down pagan temples in the area.
And following that, the Islamic period.
Yes, the study indicates the region's integration into the expanding Islamic world. It references a letter from Caliph Omar ibn al-Khattab about Antioch, showing its importance early on.
Okay, jumping forward again to the Ottoman era.
The study places the region administratively within the Ottoman system. First, it was part of the Kilis Emirate, and later the larger Aleppo Vilayet, or province. And here's another interesting language point it makes. The word selnem, meaning an annual book or yearbook. The study presents it as having Kurdish origins, sal for year and name for notebook or diary. It even mentions the last selnem for Aleppo it referenced from 1908 was over 500 pages long.
Another Kurdish word popping up in official Ottoman contexts. Fascinating. What about the turbulent early 20th century, the French Mandate?
That period gets significant attention in the study. It talks about problems like banditry on the important Aleppo-Alexandretta Road, disrupting trade. But more significantly, it details the local resistance against the French occupation after the Ottomans left.
How does this study describe that resistance taking shape?
It mentions a meeting of local leaders and notables. Names like Sato Agadiko and Anan Sheikh Ismailzada are mentioned. Their goal, according to the source, was to organize armed defense, to mobilize the Kurdish population against the French forces moving in.
And were there specific battles or incidents mentioned?
Yes, several. There's the Battle of Wadi Tiran in October 1920. It also tells the story of a figure named Mihe Ibshashe, or Muho Iboshash. He initially evaded capture, then fought off a French patrol with some companions. The study says this success led to over 40 more fighters joining him. Then it describes battles in Wadi Ashla in spring 1921. It mentions a group called Jeddah Forces, led by someone named Mohammed Atonu, ambushing French soldiers after disabling a railway bridge.
Jeddah Forces. Does the study explain who they were?
It just uses that term when describing these specific actions against the French in that area. Huh. It doesn't really elaborate beyond naming them in this context within the document we're looking at.
Okay, so a specific group named in the source carrying out these actions. And there was another fight in Wadi Tiran later.
Yes. In November 1922, this one led by Sato Agadiko. The study notes one fighter, Majid Okash, was killed. Afterwards, it says French forces surrounded Sato Agadiko's village, Kasim, and threatened to bomb it if the rebels didn't give up. But apparently the situation was resolved peacefully after some local mediation efforts.
Gives you a real sense of the conflict and tension in that era. Does the study provide the administrative setup under the French?
It does. It outlines the Aleppo Vilayet around 1929, its borders. Size, 82,000 sexquadrometers population, over 400,000, and how it was divided into limwais and katas, like provinces and districts. Afrin was a kata within the Alexandretta Liwa. It gives a population figure for the Afrin kata specifically in 1954, too.
Any mention of representation in later Syrian politics?
Yes. It notes that in the 1960 Syrian National Assembly, two representatives from the Jabal al-Akra district were mentioned, Mr. Mohammed Zeni Aga al-Gabari and Sheikh Mohammed Hanan.
And finally, there was a mention of a quite difficult event from this period.
Yes. The study mentions French aerial bombardment. In March 1939, it says French planes randomly bombed villages in the Blibl and Raho areas, hitting Maidan particularly hard. It names villages like Shingile, Sheksorze, Naza, and Blilka, noting a woman was killed in Blilka. There's also a brief mention of a skirmish near Memel village in 1940.
A very complex time of transition and conflict, clearly laid out in the source. Okay, let's shift gears a bit and focus on another significant element detailed in the study, the Yazidi community and faith in the region.
Right. The study devotes a whole section to Yazidism, describing it as a distinct religious concept that emerged within Kurdistan.
How does it trace its historical roots?
Well, it discusses possible connections to ancient Avestan texts, the Zoroastrian scriptures, and potentially even roots in Median Kurdish beliefs that might predate Zoroaster himself. The study presents the view that, ethnically, Yazidism belongs to the Kurdish or Aryan heritage. It also explores ideas about where the name Yazd, Yazdan, or Azdahia comes from, linking it to Kurdish words for creation or worship.
What about the core beliefs described in this document?
A central point highlighted is the importance of Tawuz Melek, the peacock angel. The study explains Tawuz Melek is seen as the vital link between God and humans, the one who carries out God's commands. It notes he's called Pirkul, in Kurdish, which apparently means something like service king.
And their holy books?
Kitab Ejella, Book of Revelation, and Meshefer Resh, Black Book, are mentioned. There's an interesting note, though. It suggests the originals might have been in Syriac, maybe written by a deacon named Jeremiah. but if the original text of the actual Yazidi creed book was published in Kurdish back in 1914 by a scholar named Professor Peter.
That detail about the creed book's original language is noteworthy. How about the religious figures?
The study outlines the different ranks. Sheikhs, peers, who act as guides or counselors, and fakirs, sometimes called kuko fakir.
And it describes some of their specific rituals.
Yes, quite a few. For burial, it mentions washing the body, specific prayers recited in Kurdish, using a white shroud, and placing barik, which is holy soil, from their most sacred site, lalish, on the body. It details the burial position head west, face towards the sky or sunrise, and a ritual called the talqin, the saying of the moment of death.
What about prayer practices?
The study says they pray facing the sun morning, noon, and evening. It mentions a Yazidi Fatiha prayer, analogous to the Islamic one. And it notes some sheikhs also talk about praying towards the four cardinal directions in the evening. The Sanjak procession, where peacock statues are carried, is also mentioned as a ritual.
Any specific festivals highlighted?
Yes. Eid Hadir Ilyas on February 14th, Eid Al-Ajwe around December 25th, and the Hajj season, which is their pilgrimage to Lalish in Iraq.
The study also lists some Yazidi villages in the Jabal al-Akradafrin area.
It does, giving names like Basofane, Gundi Mazin, Kimore, Chizoye. It helps you picture where the community lives within the region. It also mentions a shrine, Shay Khatun, in Tinib village, which is respected by both Muslims and Yazidis locally.
Now, the study also touches on prohibitions or taboos, and it seems some are clearer than others.
Right, this is an important part where the study tries to offer clarity based on its sources. It clearly states a prohibition against marriage on Wednesday night and avoiding intimacy then. That seems straightforward. But then it tackles other things that have been subjects of misunderstanding or external claims.
Like avoiding certain words or foods.
Exactly. It acknowledges some older texts, including one attributed to Jeremiah, Anastas, and Syriac, mentioned avoiding words like curse or Satan or foods like lettuce or fish. However, the study then specifically refutes claims found in other external books and names authors like Dr. Muhammad Al-Tonji and Siddiq Al-Damluji. These other books apparently claim Yazidis don't clip their nails, don't wash after intercourse, or won't eat meat from Muslim feasts. The study we're looking at emphatically states, based on its research, that these claims are wrong. It says Yazidis do clip their nails, do wash after intercourse, and do eat meat from Muslim feasts. It directly corrects those misrepresentations.
That's a really important clarification the study provides, addressing those external misconceptions directly. Lastly, it mentions different levels of oath-taking.
Yes, it describes a hierarchy. Swearing by God's name is the most serious. Then comes Tawuz Melek, then ancestors, then the son, noting swearing by the son is also common among Kurds, generally, then parents' graves, and finally, Lalish. It shows the different weights given to oaths.
That gives a really valuable insight into the Yazidi faith as presented within this specific document. Okay, let's shift from history and belief to exploring the actual landscape and the notable sites the study describes.
Right, the study sort of takes you on a tour of the area. It starts with Nebi Huri, also known as Qurshia or Cyrus historically. It describes it as an important Byzantine city, a bishopric, even compared to Antioch in significance. We heard about Maron being active there, and the study notes there are still ruins visible, like a Roman theater and rock-cut tombs.
Then there's the Tel Andara Temple. What does it say about that?
It paints a nice picture located by the Afrin River, surrounded by orchards. The study strongly links it to the Hurrian and Mitanni civilizations we talked about earlier. It really focuses on this unique statue of a deity found there in 1956, dating to the 14th century BC. It describes its features. The beard, a conical hat like the Kurdish komikucuk, horns which signify high status, and its pose, arms raised, similar to other Mitanni depictions.
And then a very different kind of site, St. Simeon Stylites Citadel.
Yes, the famous story of St. Simeon, the ascetic who lived on top of a pillar back in the 5th century. The study mentions a piece of the column is still there, and there's this local belief that dust from it can cure fever. It describes the condition of the church and ruins, and links the site back again to Maron, that early preacher who supposedly demolished pagan temples nearby. Places like Kilute, Kifr Nebo, and Karab Shamse, which the study mentions later as having ancient ruins, would have been among those Maron targeted, according to the source.
So it lists other archaeological sites, too.
Yeah, it points to ruins at Kilute, Kifr Nebo, and Karab Shamse near St. Simeon's. Also, the Julianas Church and a Roman bath near Brad, and quite notably, a large structure described as a 5th century hotel in Kifr Nebo.
And a particular mountain holds significance.
Sheikh Barakat Mountain, The study mentions shrines on it for figures named Bori, Sisa, and David. And it specifically describes a Yazidi ritual performed on its summit on the first Wednesday of April, involving sacrifices and lighting candles.
Connecting the landscape back to the economy, what about agriculture?
Olives are key. The study states Syria has the most olive trees globally and highlights the local varieties grown here. It really emphasizes the high quality of Afrin olive oil, even citing lab analysis mentioned in the source material. Other fruits get mentioned too, like apricots, peaches, plums, pomegranates, all important crops.
And livestock.
That's described as the second pillar of the economy, mainly sheep raising. The study lists the main villages for sheep farming and gives official livestock counts from the Agricultural Directorate back in 2004.
Beyond the facts, does the study try to capture the natural beauty of the region?
Oh, absolutely. In some sections, it really shifts tone.
Yeah.
It uses quite descriptive language about the valleys, the mountains, the forests, olives, oaks, almonds, and the many springs, naming places like Kanyakurde and Alikara.
It sounds almost like parts of it read like a travelogue.
It really does feel that way sometimes. There are passages describing the experience of traveling through the area. It captures the atmosphere in villages like Kefirsini Kufurjana, which means village of paradise. The study describes it as stunningly beautiful, mentioning the scent of flowers, bird song, painting it almost like a piece of Eden.
That description really puts you there. Does it revisit historical sites but through this more descriptive lens?
Exactly. Like the tell, the mound, in Wadi al-Nishab, Gilead, Tehran, where those battles happened. The study describes it as a beautiful spot where people celebrate Nowruz, but also notes it holds layers of ancient civilizations, suggesting Hurrian, Mitanni, Median remains are likely buried there. It also points out things you can still see, like Roman bridges over the Sibon River near Nebi Huri, some apparently still standing from the 5th century AD.
So it weaves together the deep history with the tangible experience of the landscape today.
It does a great job of that, describing views from hills, the smell of blossoms or olives depending on the season, the sounds of nature, the visual beauty of the mountains. The whole journey through the study reinforces this constant theme, the deep, enduring connection between this specific land and the people who've lived on it through thick and thin across all these different eras.
This single document, then, really acts like a window into this one place, revealing so many different layers of its story.
It really does. You get this incredible tapestry of time and experience. From the immense geological forces shaping the land, through ancient empires leaving their marks, unique religious traditions developing and persisting, periods of struggle, right up to the ongoing relationship between people and their environment, and the farming, the villages, the sheer natural beauty described.
And all of that richness, all those connections, are drawn together within this one comprehensive study. It really makes you appreciate how focusing on one specific corner of the world through a source like this can unlock such a deep understanding.
It definitely does. It makes you think, doesn't it? How the physical foundation of a place, the rocks formed millions of years ago, didn't just sit there. They provided the resources, shaped the terrain, influenced where water flowed, and essentially set the stage for all the human drama, the civilizations, the cultures, the conflicts, the ways of life that unfolded there over millennia. And so much of that history, both natural and human, is still etched onto the landscape today, if you know how to look.
So when you explore a region like Jabal al-Akrad or Afrin, through the lens of a document like this, you're seeing more than just a location. You're seeing a story playing out across vast stretches of time. The geological past influences the present water sources. Echoes of empires linger in language and ruins. Ancient beliefs are still practiced. Past struggles have shaped current realities. It's a powerful reminder that truly understanding any place means seeing all those interwoven layers.